everyone, and welcome to the inaugural Caribbean Women for Climate Justice Conference. I am Duval Bazzi of the Climate Conscious Podcast, and I'm joined by Christine.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, Christine is of the Breadfruit Collective, and we're very excited for everyone who has joined in today. And I see many of you have already started putting in the chat where y'all are joining us from. If you haven't, please let us know where you are joining in from. I see we have a wide representation from Trinidad and Tobago, New York, Guyana, of course, the Bahamas. So it's very great to see you all joining us for this inaugural event in celebration of Earth Day.
Yeah, and it's also your second anniversary, Duval, so happy birthday to you too.
Thank you, yes. Second anniversary.
Yes, the Climate Conscious Podcast, 4 seasons in. I'm so proud to be a listener. I've learned so much.
Yeah, and not just a listener, but also you've been my guest, not once, but twice.
Yes. Thank you so much for inviting us, the Breadfruit Collective, to join this initiative. It makes me so happy to celebrate Earth Day in this very special way. And again, thank you to everyone who's joining in today. It's so nice, the reach that we have.
Yes. You know, when I was thinking about, you know, how should I mark this milestone? Last year, we had a series of Instagram Live. We had the Climate Conscious Week. So it's nice to see us able to progress and to extend our partnership to now host this conference.
Yeah, definitely. And I would like to say on behalf of the two of us, thank you so much to Open Society Foundation for supporting us and for sharing your resources. We do appreciate it. And also a big, big thank you to our community co-sponsors in the Caribbean and across the diaspora who's been sharing the events and, you know, getting the word out about the conference and for believing in us. We really do appreciate the space that we share with you because you do this work every day.
Yes. Big up to Oro and Open Society Foundations. So 2 years ago on Earth Day 2020, the Climate Conscious Podcast was launched as an independent project for communication and advocacy on issues of climate change and environmental sustainability. Specifically, it set out to amplify Caribbean voices and perspectives on climate action and sustainable development. I had observed that the global climate conversation was dominated by the developed nations, while the lived experience of small and developing territories was not being highlighted very much in the mainstream. And so I set out to change this. On the Climate Conscious Podcast, we think globally, but we always bring it home. We've explored a wide range of topics on the podcast, from energy to fashion. But today, we place the spotlight on gender and climate. Why Caribbean Women for Climate Justice? Well, our best efforts towards achieving sustainable development and improving the region's capacity to withstand natural hazards and climate impacts will all be in vain if they do not prioritize equality. We know that the climate crisis amplifies existing inequalities. Simply put, our women and girls are disproportionately affected by the climate crisis. Now, one of the main objectives for hosting the Caribbean Women for Climate Justice Conference is to initiate a regional alliance of partners and key actors for climate and gender justice, establishing a solid network for collaboration and also for influencing public policy and actions. We hope that beyond the conference, you would continue to partner with us as we create a database of stakeholders who are working on issues of climate change and gender in the region. The heartbeat of the Caribbean is its people, vibrant, creative, resilient. I am so inspired by the cohort of brilliant and dynamic speakers who have answered the call to address this issue. Through partnerships, we unlock the potential of the region. I'm grateful to Christine, Afifa, and Ayana of the Breadfruit Collective for believing in this vision. And I can't thank them enough for their commitment and hard work. I am extremely thankful to the Open Society Foundation for graciously sponsoring this event. What would the Caribbean look like if the needs of our women and girls are taken into consideration? That's the question we've come together to explore and find a pathway to this goal. By the end of this conference, we hope to have a clear idea and clear strategies for advancing gender equality and climate justice in the Caribbean. Today, we commence our exploration looking at human rights and climate justice, as all our problems stem from systemic oppression, injustices, and the exploitation of people and resources. We hope to dismantle this model of development in favor of one that is equitable, sustainable, and resilient. Our people and our planet depend on it. And so I wish you an early, happy 8th day and a fruitful conference. Thank you.
Christine? Thank you so much, Durval. That was amazing. Thank you. So I'm going to follow with some words as well. Hello, friends, and happy Earth Month. What a beautiful way to celebrate with my fellow Caribbean climate advocates who do this work every day. It brings me much happiness knowing that this is the outcome of what can happen when four young girls come together with determination. Thank you for supporting us. I'm Christine Sumwaru, the founder of the Breadfruit Collective, an emerging NGO in Guyana that aims to take a whole of society approach in addressing the intersections of gender and environmental justice. The climate crisis is not gender neutral, and therefore we must use a feminist framework. The violence that has been and continue to be done against us and the earth are interconnected. I fell in love with the earth through gardening with my grandmother, and I became a gender activist at 15 by protesting against domestic violence, again with my grandmother. During the planning process of this conference, my grandma passed away. I remember coming home from her wake and having two tabs open on my computer. One with the funeral program I was helping my family create, and the other, the conference invitation letter that I was editing to be sent out. I say this because environmentalism is not new to the Caribbean, and it is time we tap into our own ancestral wisdom. I stand on the many sacrifices of the women before me who came and cared for the land, who live within their means and continue to live within their means. And now I'm privileged to be part of the climate justice movement. With this comes the duty to mentor and be of service to those younger than me. This is an intergenerational movement, one of justice, one that is not fair. Again, one that is not fair. But Caribbean people, especially Caribbean women, are resilient. I often compare them to the breadfruit tree, because like the breadfruit tree, they overcome and they have solutions. This conference means so much. We are creating our own space, forging solutions, and supporting each other along the way. The climate crisis is one I think about every day. I stay hopeful because even on a damaged planet, she provides and supports everyone I love. I'm hopeful because this is what can happen when four young Caribbean women come together. I know the next 3 days would be filled with wisdom, solutions, and inspiration. We have already been taking action. Just look at our speakers, our panelists, and our community co-sponsor. This crisis means everything. It is the fight of my generation, and I'm committed to it, and I'm grateful to be in community with people who are also committed to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine. And Christine, you truly embody the resilience of the breadfruit tree. You know, even in the midst of your period of grief, you remain committed to this cause, and I must say thank you. So,
thank you so much, Durval.
One of the things I always emphasize in doing sustainability work and climate work is partnerships. And, you know, this would not have been possible without partnership and collaboration. And this is something we hope to see more of. So, getting into today's program, I now have the honor of introducing our moderator for this evening's panel, Ms. Malini Allen. Nalini is a Jamaican human rights lawyer and founder of Freedom Imaginaries, an organization that uses human rights law to tackle legacies of slavery and colonialism. She holds a Master's of Law degree from Harvard Law School and a Master of Advanced Studies degree from the Graduate Institute of International Studies, Geneva. She is qualified to practice law in Guyana and Jamaica. Let's all welcome our moderator for this evening, Ms. Malini Allen. Over to you, Malini.
Well, thanks so much for the introduction, Christine, and for the invitation to participate in this landmark conference. And welcome to everyone to this panel on human rights and climate justice. Again, my name is Malini Allen, and I couldn't be more thrilled to moderate this panel. As was said, the theme for today is human rights, women's rights, and the rights of Indigenous peoples in the context of climate crisis. And as Derval said, the climate crisis is, I mean, there's nothing really surprising about it. It's the logical consequence of a racial capitalist system built on ecocide and Indigenous dispossession. But still, there is an urgency around the issue today, and the timeliness of this discussion cannot be overstated. Climate change represents the foremost threat to the full exercise of human rights today. This is a justice issue since we in the Caribbean are disproportionately impacted. And within Caribbean countries, climate change has particularly devastating impacts on already marginalized communities, including women. And of course, women who experience intersecting forms of subordination are even more vulnerable. Yet, within the Caribbean, Caribbean governments are promoting extractivist development despite scientific consensus that dominant modes of extractivism are fueling the climate crisis. So we urgently need a just transition for the Caribbean, a transition that centers human rights and nature in our vision of development. And in this context, I'm thrilled to be in conversation with this amazing panel, and I look forward to a lively question and answer with the audience at the end of the discussion. So as we get started, again, please introduce yourselves in the chat. And of course, feel free to send your questions in the question and answer box at the bottom of your screen. So without further ado, it's my absolute pleasure to introduce our panelists. Charlina Neger is a queer cisgender Guyanese ecofeminist. She earned a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Chicago and a master's in public health from Emory University, and has worked on a variety of issues such as violence prevention, women's empowerment, environmental justice, human rights, local policy, and nonprofit management for over two decades. Charlina currently lives in Guyana, where she engages in grassroots mobilization and advocacy around issues of sexual and reproductive health and rights, economic justice, sustainability, and transformative leadership. Our second panelist is Immaculata Casimero, who is an Indigenous woman who belongs to the Wapicha Nation in Guyana. She is the communications officer at South Rupununi District Council and the co-founder of Wapichan Women's Movement. Her journey as a village leader began in 2015 when she served as secretary of the Aishilton Village Council for 3 years. In July 2019, Immaculata traveled to Geneva to represent the voices of Wapichan women to the UN CEDAW committee. She helped to organize the first Rupununi Indigenous Women's Conference, which brought together over 80 women to discuss and focus on gender, leadership, environmental issues, and empowerment. Then we have Sapphire Alexander, a strident feminist and youth advocate who is passionate about equal rights and climate change awareness. She's the founder of Caribbean Feminist, a digital initiative and platform for young people to come together and to learn from each other, inspire and be inspired themselves. Sapphire is also a member of the Queen's Commonwealth Trust Network, as well as a member of the Young Feminist Coalition, Transform Education. She also stands on the Caribbean Advisory Committee for the International Nonprofit Frida, where she aids in informing the grant-making process for the region. Sapphire lives by the credo that by elevating the voices of the youth, this is the key to progress of society. And Sapphire, I couldn't agree with you more. Last but not least, we have Ruana Haynes, who is an international climate law and governance specialist and TEDx 2020 speaker with over a decade of experience in the UN climate process. A former Trinidad and Tobago diplomat, Ruwana has negotiated for the Caribbean community as well as the Alliance of Small Island States, including in the development of the Sustainable Development Goals. At present, she is Senior Legal Advisor at Climate Analytics and Director of the Climate Analytics Caribbean Office in Trinidad and Tobago. Ruwana provides strategic, technical, and diplomatic advice to island states in climate change negotiations, as well as training for officials new to the UN climate process. And with that, I'm just so overwhelmed by the breadth of talent and knowledge and expertise on this panel with multidisciplinary experiences and perspectives. And so with that, as we launch this discussion, I'd like to invite each panelist to tell us a little bit more about the work they're doing and how they think human rights tie into environmental issues and climate justice in their country. So Charlena, can I ask you to kick things off?
Sure. Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Very, very happy to be here. Right, so a little bit about myself. I mean, you've already heard, but I live in Guyana right now. My academic training is in public health. So I look at everything from a wellness lens, I would say. And public health, it's also a very broad lens. So it allows me to connect lots of issues that I care about. And, you know, that's really the way that makes the most sense to me because everything is connected. But sometimes, you know, we tend to get stuck in silos. And so part of the work that I do, whether it's working on, you know, sexual and reproductive health and rights or gender-based violence, safe abortion, animal rights, it's really to connect people and organizations. And so, you know, looking at things from a wellness lens and also empowerment as key. So a lot of what I do also is organizing. So it's working at mostly the grassroots level, although there is some organizational and policy change work that I'm involved with. But I do really, you know, believe that, you know, saying about the personal, the political, and oftentimes we have to start with self and the individual and build out to families and communities and then organizations and nations regionally. So I work on a variety of issues. They're all connected. And of course, you know, when we think about human rights and the environment, as Malini, you know, said, and I think we'll get into this hopefully some more in the discussion, we, for a long time, you know, we humans have been separated, divorced from the natural environment. And now a lot of us see the environment as something separate, outside of us. And really, you know, that is part of the problem. That is the whole extractive capitalism, you know, model started out by extracting us humans from nature and severing this connection that we had. And it's the very models that, you know, disempower people and, you know, don't respect their basic human rights. Those are the same models that are in play when it comes to environmental issues and environmental abuses. And oftentimes, you know, it's people who are the most vulnerable, the most disempowered on whether it's economically or in terms of access to justice and services. Those are the same folks who are then affected when there's an environmental crisis. But so it's, you know, a lot of the work that I engage in is really, like I said, helping people to, it's a lot of dialoguing and a lot of getting folks to share their perspective and their experience and, you know, understanding that violence, economic violence, gender-based violence, it's linked to the practices in how we treat with the environment. And it's really, you can't talk about human rights and not talk about the environment. And it's really a way of, again, connecting the dots with people, the lens of justice and equity that we apply to people, we also apply or could be applied to the environment, you know? So it's how people interact with each other and the environment, but also recognizing that the environment has rights too, right? So it's not just a resource for us people to use as we want. It's necessary and it's part of our lives, and there's a respect factor that goes into that, which, you know, understanding that humans are part of the environment. And there are other species and other living things which are also important and crucial. And really that respect each other and difference, and acknowledging that we all have a role to play, and that if one part, you know, is negatively affected, then there's likely going to be a ripple effect on other parts as well. So it's really, seems like a clear and basic connection. But because we, you know, again, have been separated, it's sometimes new to people, or they have to be reminded, or it takes a lot of talking to get that awareness. So that's the work I do, and I'm happy to be here and looking forward to hearing more from everyone else.
Thanks so much, Charlena. And you know what you said about humans being a part of nature is so important. I think we often forget. So thanks so much for your introduction. And we will move now to Immaculata Casimero to give an introduction to her work and how she sees human rights tying into environmental and climate justice issues. Immaculata?
Hi, good evening, everyone. I am Immaculata Casimero. My Wapcha name is Mabap, which means Queen Bee. And I'm so happy to be here, to be joining all you amazing women and other persons who are listening to us today. Well, I'm a mother of four children, and I belong to the Wapcha Nation, as I was introduced earlier. I work with the South Rupne District Council. So my job entails communication and even having grounded information from my leaders on a daily basis. And what I have been doing, I have been working to educate Indigenous women so they can feel well informed about climate change and its impact on our communities, and feel comfortable sharing the knowledge with others. Just a few weeks ago, there was a women's conference that brought together almost 90 Indigenous women to discuss climate change, its effects on the lives. And also one topic that came out that from the women, it's that they were particularly vulnerable to food insecurity, which has resulted from climate change. And also at the climate, at this conference, we tried to teach them, myself and the other women from the Wapcha Norwegian Women's Movement, on the, I would say, new terminologies, for example, nature-based solutions, and the idea that focus on protecting nature and biodiversity through sustainable actions, like allowing forests to regrow is a way of combating climate change. And also, we know that as Indigenous Wapchan people, we are located at a carbon sink. And so we try to educate the women, educate our people on what is happening. We know that our forests play very important roles, and we actually as Indigenous people, as Indigenous women, are the inventors of nature-based solutions. So to combat climate change, we have been doing a lot of work also from the SRDC, capturing aerial images of impacted areas on our lands. We have been doing a lot of advocacy, trying to have governments meet with us so we can resolve some of the issues that we have. So this is something that we have been doing at the grassroots level. So when we talk about human rights, for me, it centering human rights means that we value the environment that we have over profits. And any development, whether in the mining, oil, or any other industry, needs to be compatible with human rights. Centering human rights means informing people when their rights are at stake and allowing community engagement. That is something very important for us, especially when we have activities that are proposed on our lands as Indigenous people. And also giving us that opportunity to protest or even have boycotts of other plans that are being made without our consent. Also, centering human rights also means giving people whose rights are at stake a say in decision-making on what happens to the lands that are being exploited and not following the desire of foreign investors at the expense. Centering human rights, for me, prioritizes being a global citizen. Wherever we live, in the Caribbean, in Asia, myself in Aishalton, we have to be aware of the actions that are taken or that are not taken. We have a ripple effect on the rest of the globe. This crisis, we know, is inescapably global. It's affecting all of us. Despite even my people's sustainable customs as Wapchan people, we are also affected. And although the crisis originates in human activity outside of my community, we are still responsible to ensure the mitigation of climate change. Thank you.
Immaculata, thanks so much for your perspectives. And, you know, being able to hear from you as an Indigenous woman, mother of four, on your perspectives on centering human rights, I think it's so important. And I think, you know, harnessing Indigenous knowledge and practices and ways of being in terms of how we think about development, I think is so important. So I really appreciate hearing from you. And this is a good kind of segue too to Sapphire, who is a youth activist. And so I would love to hear from Sapphire, you know, wearing your lens as a youth activist, you know, how do you see your role in terms of, you know, this movement for human rights and climate justice? And, you know, tell us about your work, how you, you know, advance climate justice and how you see the links between human rights and climate justice.
Thank you so much, Maleen. Hi, everyone. I'm Sophia Alexander. Like she would have mentioned, I'm a youth activist from Trinidad and Tobago. A lot of my work centers around women's rights and feminism. That's my kind of center of operations. And yeah, that's actually how I became connected with Christine in the first place, is that we had a solidarity circle recently for International Women's Day, speaking about climate justice and the link between feminism and climate justice. So that is a lot of the lens within which I understand the impacts of climate change on our human rights. Just to answer your question really, really simply, I think that there is no human rights without environmental justice. I don't think that we can have our human rights without, because if you look at basic human rights, there's things like access to food, access to water, and safety in yourself. And the climate crisis specifically threatens those basic human rights and human justices. If you look at it from a feminist lens and a feminist perspective, you look and you understand that women and girls are often the ones who face the climate crisis first. They face the impacts of it firsthand. Those are the people who, when we experience environmental disasters, when we experience things like hurricanes, they are the ones who are most at risk. They are the ones who experience, they are the ones who are at the front line. So that is my understanding of the link between human rights and climate justice. And that would be where my lens comes in with my work and the link between my work and climate justice.
Thanks so much, Sapphire. And I just had to write in the chat, you know, brilliantly said, there is no human rights without environmental justice. And I mean, when you think about it, if we can't have something as basic as a healthy environment where we can breathe clean air and, you know, drink clean water, then there's really no point to life. So very just perfectly said. And with that, I'd like to move to our last but not least, last speaker, Ruwana. And I think this is an interesting progression because we just heard from people, you know, working on the ground, grassroots mobilization in their communities. And now we're moving to someone who works at, you know, the policy level, regional and international. And so I'm very excited to hear from you, Ruwana, about how you see the links between human rights and environmental justice in your work, as you tell us a bit more about, you know, the exciting work that you do.
Thank you, Malini. And hi, everyone. It's really such a privilege to be here to listen to all of you. I'm so happy that I'm going last because I really value the opportunity to hear from to hear this particular perspective from those who are working on the ground. So as Malini said, my work is primarily at the policy level, primarily at the international, to some degree also at the regional levels. I think there are a lot of interlinkages that I could speak to demonstrate the impact of the work that I do in this area and how human rights definitely is the climate change issue of the day. I'll start with, I want to branch off of something Shalina said in terms of the need to make connections. So in my work, primarily, I try to make connections between what governments are saying in our region and the international stage. And that is no easy task. In the context of the work that the speakers here do, it's more of an issue of operating at a domestic and national level, where quite frequently, as Malini put it, our own governments are the big bad guys, right? How dare they promote extractive industries in a context where we know that we're in the midst of a crisis and we know that it is impacting our own people on the ground. In the context that I work in, our governments are actually the good guys. The guys who are trying really hard to demonstrate to the rest of the international community that this crisis is exceedingly urgent, that it requires not just incremental action, but transformational action, and that our countries that are being disproportionately impacted cannot be left behind in the just transition. So what I would say in terms of making connections, there is no just transition possible at the domestic level within our countries if there is not a corresponding just transition happening at the international level. It is simply not possible. Our countries are small. They are, you know, economically really on the fringes of the global economic playing field, and they do not have a lot of influence. That means that they do not make the rules of the game that we all have to play in this primarily inhumane capitalist system that we find ourselves. And so this is the situation. And so it is quite a task actually trying to demonstrate that in a context where leaders of the group of 20 most economically powerful countries in the world make decisions around whether or not they will continue subsidizing coal, whether or not they will continue going into countries like India, for example, or South Africa, and propping up coal industries with billions of dollars, as opposed to doing the same, but for renewable energy. So it's quite a task to make the case that those decisions are actually impacting the daily lives of people living in countries on the front line in our societies. At the international level, there's often a game of whose life is worth more, if you can believe it. And so you would have countries like India speak to the fact that their populations are so large, really what impacts them cannot be compared to what impacts our much smaller populations. And so they would make an equity case for preserving their space for economic development, which is code language for their space to continue polluting. And so when we elevate these issues up to the international level, they become about 30 times more complex than they are at a domestic or even a regional level. But always the human rights thread is at the center. It's at the center of everything that we do. It is the most powerful basis for action. It is the most powerful rallying cry for support. And so in terms of the linkages, I would say that it's very much the backbone of the work that I do at the international, at the global and regional levels. I would agree that our governments have much more work to do. They have much more work to do in their own response to the crisis, but they have possibly even more work to do in terms of their efforts to inform and educate. And that's the other area in which I work primarily at the regional level. You would have heard from Malini that I am the director of a recently established office based in Trinidad and Tobago, Climate Analytics Caribbean. And our work in this space really centers on building the capacity of civil society organizations within the region. We are a member of an existing climate justice network that's led by Canary and also supported by the Open Societies Foundation. And we are hoping to be able to do work that would allow us to properly define this term climate justice and all of its various interconnections, but to give it a Caribbean stamp and a Caribbean flavor that we can then take to the international level. So the last thing I would say is that in that sense, there is a global process underway called the Global Stocktake, which is a stocktake of all the work that has happened since we established the Paris Agreement in 2015, with a view to identifying where there are gaps to implementation and where further work needs to be done. As part of that process, it is possible for civil society organizations from all over the world, not just governments, to make an input. So part of the work that we will be doing as well, we'll be working with various civil society organizations at the regional level to make an input into that process, to be able to put our own perspective, which is, as Malini rightly said, usually sidelined, into that process in a much more compelling way. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rowena. Just very interesting to hear what happens at the policy level, at the international and regional levels. And what struck me a lot about what you said, Rowena, was this concept of preserving space for development. And I think you mentioned that in the context of India, for example. And, you know, we can think about it in our own context in the Caribbean, because, you know, whenever we talk about the linkages between extractivist development and climate crisis, and we talk about, you know, countries like Guyana barreling forward with an oil and gas industry at a time when, you know, there's scientific consensus that fossil fuels are fueling the climate crisis, the pushback is, well, what about our right to development, especially as developing countries? So I guess the question I have, well, for everyone on the panel, and I invite the audience as well to join in on the discussion, is, you know, what is development and how do we define development? Because it strikes me that it's seemingly there's this view that there is an inevitable trade-off between development and our right to health and a healthy environment. But what do you think is, you know, how do you think about development in the Caribbean context? And since I mentioned Guyana, maybe we can start off with Charlina and Immaculata to hear their perspectives.
Right. So, yes, Guyana is a great example, I would say, of what not to do in terms of development. And yes, so this very trade-off in terms of human development, you know, must come at the cost of the environment, is what we're seeing right now with the oil boom and lots of talk that, you know, this oil wealth will lead to our development as a nation, where, you know, we have had lots of other things that would make us wealthy, like bauxite and gold and land and timber and an unspoiled ecosystem. You know, we have lots of resources which could be used to build an economy that is not destructive to the environment. And that hasn't happened over the decades, but you're still hearing from our politicians and our, I call them misleaders, that, you know, that is, this is our right and we need to catch up to the other countries in the world. And there are clear examples from our neighbors in Trinidad, which has been an oil-producing country for over a century, from Venezuela right next door, as well as, you know, across the world, that there is never a good outcome, much less this particular time and space that we find ourselves in, right? So part of you know, what we are trying to do is to have conversations, again, with people on the ground who might be thinking that oil in Guyana is a good thing because then they get a job, or maybe some of their services will be bought or used by people in the oil industry and then they will get an economic boost. So the question we're asking is, or the what we're trying to get people to think about is beyond just the short term, and really think about what living this way, doing things this way, what kind of world does that leave for the next generation? Your children, your grandchildren, and then thinking seven generations down, right? Which is what, you know, a lot of indigenous cultures, that's the lens that they use. It's not just the immediate, you know, how much money is in my pocket or my bank account right now. It's really the future, you know? And if we want to continue to be on this planet, which is really we only have one planet right now, so I don't know where else, you know, humans are gonna be. And if we continue to want to, you know, enjoy going outside and, you know, not wearing, you know, gas masks to breathe and, you know, and having a, you know, a kind of life which our grandparents and our ancestors have, we want our children, grandchildren, great grandchildren to have some kind of similar life, we need to think about and the decisions that we and the leaders who act in our name, that the decisions they make. And so, you know, not all development is good development. Development means more than just a fat bank account. These are some development should be, you know, not just a short-term thing, but we need to think, you know, seven generations down the line. Those are some of the concepts that we are trying to, you know, it have dialogue with fellow Guyanese, and, you know, looking again, of course, regionally and internationally, about, you know, for examples and persons who can share their perspective. So that's what I would say for Guyana. And Max, you much to add?
Okay, everyone. Well, for me, I think when you think about development right now, when you look at development, everyone thinks it's having good infrastructure, roads, buildings, but the infrastructure might be there, but then the services that are available are still not proper. For example, like the health. I know you might have a good new hospital, but then you lack staff, you don't have medication, you don't have the simple things as pregnancy tests in a hospital, and the building is well made. So sometimes we as humans, I would say generally, see development as having more infrastructure. But for me, as Indigenous people, sometimes we all want development. Yes, we do want the buildings, but we want every other service that comes with it. But when we look at what development brings, it also brings a lot of destruction. Trees, forests, you know, to make roads to go into the areas, you destroy important habitat, key areas. And I just want to say that, as Sharina said in her first presentation, that I think it's because as humans, we are disconnected. We're disconnected from nature, that we have seen everything as the dollar sign, I would say. You know, everything for us is money. That we don't see our environment as important, which we should see it as important, because if we don't have a clean and healthy environment, then how are we going to exist? What the development that we have won't be able to save us as human beings or as people. So for me is having development when you have to think about nature. We tend to follow the Western type of development, which is very, I would say, harmful to nature, very harmful to Mother Earth. We extract many of her resources, which my mom always says are the foundations of the earth. That's why she's sick today, because just like when you have a house, you build a foundation very strong that it can stand. All the minerals that we are extracting, you know, and because of, I would say, greed at times also, we're destroying the foundation of Mother Earth. And in that way, we are the ones who are going to bear the consequences of our actions. So for me, is I would like to see my community develop with all proper lights and proper roads and stuff, but we have to think about nature. We must have nature in our mind when we think of development. That's what I would like to say. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Immaculata. And you know, before we move to other panelists to hear their input on that question, what strikes me about what you're saying is that, you know, Indigenous knowledge can kind of teach us a lot in terms of what development should look like, you know, in a context where we're respecting human rights and nature as well. And so there would be huge benefit in having inclusive decision-making processes where Indigenous communities are included in the decision-making process in a meaningful way. And when it comes to Indigenous lands, I mean, that is a requirement of international human rights law to have, you know, free prior informed consultation and consent. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience with participation in decision-making processes, especially when it comes to your land, ancestral lands? Okay, Immaculata may have some connection challenges, so we'll come back to Immaculata on that. But maybe I'll hand over to Sapphire in the meantime, because I think, was it Ruana who spoke about intergenerational justice, meaning thinking, or was it maybe Sharlina, thinking about development in a way that will leave behind, you know, a good environment for future generations. So in that context, and given, you know, the warming of the earth, what is your view on development in the Caribbean?
Yeah, I think we tend to have a really short-sighted approach to development. We tend to think about what can benefit us in the now instead of what life is going to look like for future generations. And I think my statement there really echoes what Immaculata and Sharlina were saying earlier in their contributions. I mean, especially as a young person, for me, it's really chilling to think what the world is going to look like, what the Caribbean, where I live, is going to look like when I decide to have children in the future, or when my children's children inhabit the earth. Hopefully they're able to live in the Caribbean, because we understand that with sea level rise, the Caribbean may not be here in the generations of my children's children. And I think that here in the Caribbean, to echo what Immaculata was saying, we tend to have this really Eurocentric approach to development, where we think that development means infrastructure, but then that leads to environmental degradation, which echoes that same point of not having space for our children's children. And then you also think about the fact that, to me, it's so chilling to see us invest so much here in the Caribbean into oil and natural gas, while simultaneously seeing images of scientists in the UK chaining themselves to buildings and demanding an end to the sale of fossil fuels, saying that this is not the way to continue into the future. And it's really chilling, you know, understanding that oil and gas is a non-renewable resource. And it takes so much from other industries and other paths of investment, like agriculture and education and human resources, where those finances are needed the most. So to see the government have such a short-sighted approach to development as a young person is really chilling, and it doesn't give me the best feelings about my future. But I think there's a question later on about hope, and that ties in a little bit to that.
Thanks so much, Sapphire. And I think when you say things like, it doesn't give you much like positive thinking when you think about the future based on this current trajectory, I think that should trickle right up to the highest levels of decision-making to just really express how urgent the situation is. And I think Immaculata is back with us. So Immaculata, I was asking you about, you know, in the participation of Indigenous communities in decision-making processes as a way to shape development in ways that are more rights-centered and earth-centered. And I was asking if you could share with us, you know, your experiences in Guyana in terms of, you know, participation in decision-making processes when it comes to development.
Yes, thanks for the question. Well, from what has been happening in my territory is that there are developmental plans being made without properly consulting us. We have not been involved, and then decisions are being made here at the national level. And instead of having good proper consultations, free prior informed consent, we are just, I would say, development is imposed upon us as the Wapchan people. For example, at Marodi Mountain, that is the mining activities that are happening. And up to date, we have not been able to receive that agreement that was signed by the companies and the government. It's almost 5 months, I would say 6 months now. And so for us, we need to be consulted. We need to have effective participation because our lives can be impacted. I forgot to mention earlier, also part of our work as the Wapchan people, we're trying to protect the headwaters of our main rivers that flow from that area. And if mining is to continue in the way it is happening, our like five rivers are going to be polluted, and it will not just be the Wapchan people. It will also be the Makushi people who depend on the rivers for their livelihoods. So all of these developments are happening without the effective participation of the Wapchan people. And that is something that we have been really calling on to see how we can be involved, or we can be included in the different decisions that are being made at the, I would say, national level here in Guyana.
Thanks so much, Immaculata. And I was wondering if Ruwana, you could maybe say something as well about, you know, this question of development, sticking with this concept of development, because, you know, what we're hearing from the community level, for example, the youth perspective, Indigenous perspectives from Guyana, is, you know, there is a difference between the community perspective on development, what it should be, and the type of development that's actually being put forward by governments and, you know, people with decision-making power. So, you know, wearing your hat in spaces that you know, engage in negotiation and stuff like that, what is the vision of development being put forward in those spaces? And do you see like a disconnect between that vision and what's being communicated on the ground? And then what are your own views on, you know, development in the Caribbean context, given the climate crisis?
I would agree that there is a massive disconnect. I mean, this is also part of why I do what I do, to try to address that disconnect. I would say at the international level, leaders from the region, they can talk a good talk about sustainable development and the principles of sustainable development and, you know, the need to ensure that there's that integration of environmental concerns and social concerns into the whole paradigm of economic development. So that has been very well developed and advanced at a policy level in terms of what they see internationally. I mean, there's an entire sustainable development global process just for small island developing states that was started in 1994 and continues today to address those issues. At the same time, when we look at what is happening, and we've heard it here, at the domestic level, on the inside, in terms of decisions that are being made, in terms of priorities that are being set, evidently lip service is being paid to this issue of sustainable development. And, you know, there are a few reasons for that. Definitely the short-sightedness is key. Many of our leaders cannot see beyond a five-year horizon. And so priorities get set and decisions are made in order to ensure that at that five-year horizon, they can be re-elected. And, you know, the rationale is a re-election will guarantee that they can work for the greater good. The second thing is, and I see it coming up in the chat a lot, this issue of simply a lack of education and understanding. I'm a firm believer in the fact that we get the leaders we deserve. And many of them are being voted in and re-elected. And you have to ask yourself the question why, in terms of what is happening in the minds of the majority, that they are okay with a short-term vision for a lopsided type of development, which is what we have been getting since our various independence days. So almost 60 years now. So this is, I think, a real pressing concern, that in order to change the understanding of what is development, the change actually has to start at community level. I was in conversation with someone the other day who was saying that they prefer one supermarket to another. And why? Because the supermarket that they don't like does not give plastic bags. And the supermarket that they do like gives you plastic bags to carry your groceries, which is how it should be. It's a more civilized way of thinking. And so, aside from being deeply shocked and flabbergasted, I tried to get to the root of why this individual thought that plastic bags represent advancement. And it was really difficult. And I had to recall that when I was growing up, you got your groceries in a brown paper bag. And that was fine. That was great. And then at some point, we made this transition to plastic, the advancement. And that thinking that these things like plastic, air condition, concrete jungle homes, you know, concrete yards, that thinking has taken root and it's still very much there. And so it is difficult for me to see, even with as much pressure from civil society as possible, it is difficult for me to see a situation where governments will change their approaches if there is not that concurrent change in understanding and belief and mindset also coming from the community levels. Because at the end of the day, governments will set priorities and make decisions that ensure their re-election. So they are speaking to somebody. So that's my take on this. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Ruano. And to continue with this discussion on development, I just want to bring in a question from the question and answer from the audience. And I encourage the audience to continue sending us questions that we can send to the panelists. And so this question is from Sylvia Liahu Aluas. And she's asking, how viable would the Costa Rica model of economic development balanced with nature protection be for the Caribbean? Is there a particular country that you consider as a model of human rights and climate justice? So I see Charlena started to respond to this question. Charlena, would you like to share with the audience some of your perspectives?
Oh yeah, I just mentioned Belize as an example of a country which has oil in their offshore waters, but it took many years of a lot of community organizing, but they eventually were able to prevent that oil from being developed by focusing on blue tourism, which is keeping the waters. They have a lot of coral reefs and a lot of tourists come to dive and to, you know, have that blue water Caribbean experience. And, you know, it took many years, like I said, they were successful in prioritizing that, this eco-tourism blue water model as opposed to oil. Drilling for the oil levels that is in the water. So that's an example of it can happen when people, mobilize and hold one hand, which, is what needs to happen, which is so challenging. But yeah, there are models. It is possible.
Does anyone else want to respond to that question about models of economic development? Okay. Oh, yes, Sapphire.
Yeah, if I may, I just wanted to speak really quickly on the point of Costa Rica as a model. And I think that it ties in really nicely with what Rado was saying, which was so poignant, which is that the change has to be at a community level, because the case with Costa Rica is a combination of government innovation and a community that really valued environmental justice and sustainable environmental practices, because their decision to not pursue fossil fuels back when they were approached and to focus on a more sustainable model and to focus more on environmental preservation in Costa Rica had to do with the country's desire for environmental justice and their understanding of the importance of preserving their natural resources and preserving their natural environment. So it ties in completely with what Rana is saying. It ultimately depends on what the society in that country values. And I think Nikita said it in the chat really, really nicely. There needs to be a transformational change in societal thinking. And I think that is the only way that a model like Costa Rica could work. I'm speaking from here in Trinidad. It has to be changed at a societal level.
Yes, absolutely. And just to reinforce what you and Ruana are saying as well, another comment from Lisa Perch. All these things are tied to fossil fuel consumption and the sense that the more consumptive we are, the more advanced and developed we are, and indeed the public is not always with us on sustainability. So this need for like awareness raising at the most intimate of spaces, to influence how people even go to the supermarket and what their expectations are in terms of how they will be served at the supermarket, And we have another question here in the chat, building on what Ruana was saying as well. A question from Janelle Christian. And she says, great discussion and congratulations to Ruana on her new role. Often little or no opportunity is provided to civil society organizations and in particular indigenous people from Guyana and the region to make an independent contribution at the international level. My question is, what support is available or will be provided to build capacity to have strong regional collective in this regard?
Should I take that, Malini?
Oh, yes, sure. Thanks.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Janelle, that's literally what keeps me up at night. I'm not going to lie. A part of why I really wanted to, I guess, transition myself from focusing internationally to doing work more at the regional level is precisely to help to do that. I will say there aren't a lot of resources available, but I think that situation is slowly getting better. What I would love is if those of you who are interested in getting involved in this work in particular, and also probably through the Caribbean Climate Justice Network that has been set up by the Caribbean Natural Resources Institute, please feel free to contact me and let me know so that we can involve you all into those discussions, because the intention is to create a space where we can all learn from each other, and through that collective learning, be able to hone ourselves into one powerful voice directed both at our governments, but also internationally, because there is that opportunity to make an impact internationally. And truth be told, our governments could use all the help that they can get at that level. So please do be in touch. I hope that between Duval and Christine, they will share our contact details from the panel. Thanks.
Thanks, Ruana. And taking more great questions from the chat, I see there's a lively discussion taking place in the chat and the question and answer as well. This question is from Sidel Felician. And the question is, and this is a great question, do you believe that because the Caribbean has a lack of their own institutions, in that most of our institutions have been influenced by European standards, we need to fit what we believe development is to meet their standards, leading to the difficulties in the realm of climate change and sustainable development? So anyone wants to take that really great question that really just goes to the heart of things? Well, as the panelists think about that question, and I hope we hear from the panel, just to offer my perspective on that, I mean, I couldn't put it any better. You know, I think the climate crisis, as we said, is rooted in this racial capitalist world order. But when we look at this racial capitalist system, it is made up of institutions, practices, ways of being, and ideologies that were developed by, you know, or former colonizers to put forward a very specific form of development. And that form of development invariably, you know, leads to the subordination of certain people. And those people are formerly colonized nations and racially, you know, racialized communities. And so, you know, when we talk about climate justice, I think we must absolutely speak about the transformation of institutions, the transformation about how we think about decision-making processes, transformation of governance forms, which today I think are still neo-colonial and colonial governance forms that, as Immaculata was describing, systematically marginalizes certain people from decision-making. So with that little tidbit from me, I see Ruana has her hand up. So Ruana, I hand over to you.
Yeah, I just raised my hand to wholeheartedly agree with you. And probably to add one small example of how that works as well, even in the context of the climate process. And so, in order to be able to access funding from the Green Climate Fund or even other funds that provide funding for developing countries to take action on climate change, normally countries have to provide, especially if it's funding for an adaptation type of program, which is normally the type of program rooted in development, you have to provide what is called a climate rationale for your project. Now, in order to provide this climate rationale for your project, it means that you would, as a small country that is begging for money internationally, your climate rationale means that you would have had to have been collecting scientific data for the past 30 or so years and conducting a large amount of analysis of this data in order to be able to provide an appropriate rationale to collect funds. So you see how, in terms of the way the institutions are set up, the lack of resources that we experience, it's all a bit of a vicious cycle. So there is a discussion now happening on the possibility of allowing Indigenous knowledge as well as lived experience to take the place of some of these Eurocentric ideals around climate scientific type data. But that discussion is very nascent. It's at its beginning. And you know, these are some of the issues that I think civil society from our region can really help to push forward and to move front and center in the context of the international discussion, because trust and believe, it does have an impact on whether or not any of our organizations or institutions might be able to apply for this type of funding in the future. The funding is not just available to governments themselves. So, you know, that's just one of the ways that the system is designed really to prop itself up and to exclude.
Well, thanks, Romana. And I think a nice segue question comes from Michaela Hussein. And she's asking, I know you all do a lot of activist work. What challenges have you experienced as women advocating for human rights in climate change? You know, because we're talking about like pushing forward understandings of development in ways that are more, you know, sustainable and right-centered and earth-centered. What challenges have you faced and experienced as women advocating for human rights and climate change? I think that's a great question as well. Who wants to take a first look at that question? Women advocating for human rights and climate change. Well, is that Shirley?
Yes, I'll just say, the biggest challenge that I have faced really is that when, similarly to the talk and the discussion around human rights, it's often seen as this foreign concept, something that's being pushed by organizations, NGOs from the outside as not native, not indigenous to us here in the Caribbean. And that's kind of the same pushback that we get sometimes when we try to talk about environmental issues. It's like, that's a foreign thing. Like, why, you know, what does that really mean? Like, why are you bringing that here? So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but that is what I would say the biggest challenge that I've.
From me, Malini, I just want to say that some of the challenges also, I mean, I face as a, I would say, an Indigenous activist, is that, I mean, when you speak of these things, for example, like what is happening in my area, the mining, people see you as, I would say, from the government perspective, they would see you as anti-developmental, and that you don't need development, and you know, and they're trying to push their agenda onto the, I would say, they would involve politics greatly at the community level, where they try to influence, yes, this development is needed for you, and you must say yes, you know, is a way of, I would say, brainwashing the people. And while and when that happens, how it's very hard to really get the message of what you would like. As we were saying, we're talking about transformational change. It's really hard to actually get the message to the people on the ground, you know, because you have this other group coming with something else while you're trying to do something else as well. You know, you're trying to educate them, sensitize them, and so on. But you also have this other negative part that is coming and say, you know, branding you as anti-developmental. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this issue of stigmatization as being anti-development, if you raise any concerns about the environment or, you know, like basic things like health. And, you know, another form of stigmatization, I think, for women is this idea that we're being like emotional and getting too excited, you know. So if I could just give, you know, a description of one experience in particular. I was in a public meeting for, you know, one of the development projects as part of their mandated sensitization and public meeting process. And, you know, one of the women in the chat was raising very well-founded issues about the project. And someone, you know, was even getting upset. And in the chat, the narrative was, you know, you're getting too emotional, calm down, you're getting too upset. And it struck me that, you know, when women raise their voices and get, you know, quote unquote upset when they're just articulating, you know, very basic experiences about impact, that is how they're stigmatized. So that resonates a lot with me, Immaculata. And I see Sapphire nodding her head vigorously. So I hand over to you,
yeah, Sapphire. Yeah, I completely agree with so many of the sentiments that are being expressed, that kind of stigma of being an angry woman. I think especially in the feminist space, that's one that you get a lot, being too emotional. A lot of times people don't think that the issues that you're bringing forward are relevant at that point in time. They're like, oh, we have so many other things that we need to worry about right now. We can't focus on climate justice. We can't focus on women's rights. We can't focus on period poverty, for example. We need to focus right now on decreasing poverty, but we kind of have to recognize that these issues are intersectional and they both feed into each other. And then another one is, people tend to identify some of the issues as women's issues and not human rights issues that affect everybody. So I completely empathize with a lot of what is being experienced. I'm nodding my head because I'm like, I've been there.
Thanks so much, Sapphire. And we have one more question in the chat. I'll just address this and then we can move on to, we have two more questions that I'd love to hear from the panelists about, but I'm just really enjoying this conversation so much. And this question comes from Vidyaratha Kisoon. Hi, Vidyaratha, good to see you. I wonder if you have any concerns that the regression on environmental justice is also being connected to a reversal of progress on human rights.
I'll go first again. This is absolutely very concerning. Also when we have oil industry, you know, funding a lot of women empowerment, giving women trainings and sit expos, and you know, with the label of, you know, women's empowerment. So they're kind of buying goodwill. And supporting the interaction that needs to happen. But I think, you know, what Sapphire said and what we all have been saying is about the interconnectedness of these issues. And if we just keep being passionate and, you know, making the links, showing how the things are linked. And, you know, as we were saying, you can't talk, there is no development without human development, gender justice, you know, part and parcel of that. So we have to hold them accountable. We have power as well, right? There are more of us at the bottom than them at the top, right? And so that is part of what we are doing with networking and working collectively, is countering that narrative. We have the power and we are using our voices, and we need to keep doing more of it to make the case why this is linked and why we can't separate these two issues. And we need to focus on both of them. And we can't let one be used at the expense of the other. It's absolutely very alarming, and we need to just
thanks so much, Sherlina, and Ruana as well.
Yeah, so just to weigh in quickly on this, I agree. And it is concerning. I mean, look at what is happening in Ukraine with the Russian invasion, and then look at the policy response that we're getting from the European Union and elsewhere. I mean, European Union prides itself on being, you know, very advanced and environmentally conscious and all of these things. And for some of those countries, their first response was, okay, well, now we need to double down on investing in gas, right? Now we need to double down on investing in oil in other countries, because we have to make sure that our people have energy for heating, for life, for whatever it is that they need it for. you know, instead of going the way that you would thought that they would have gone and doubling down on renewable energy resources. So, I mean, which comes with its own particular challenges. So all of these things are interconnected, but I just wanted to say that in the same way that a regression in one place automatically drags other things down, when we lift in one area, we also lift in all areas. So for example, coming out of 2020 and the major Black Lives Matter movement, I can tell you for a fact that before that, there was really very little discussion of this notion of intersectionality between environmental justice issues and social justice issues. There was no discussion at all on what do we understand by climate justice and how do we use this term to inform all of the work that we do at the international level. It just wasn't happening. It's happening now. So in the same way that, you know, there can be that backward move, there can also be that rising tide. It's a question of, you know, what triggers it and when.
Thanks so much, Rowana. And I think that's a nice segue as well to the second, you know, major discussion question. And building on what Vidyaratha asked about human rights is, you know, what does the Caribbean of the future look like when it centers human rights? And this is a question I want to throw to the panel in general. And maybe we can start with Immaculata and work our way around.
Okay. I think I've said it before, is that we really need to value our environment firstly. And it's like you're compromising human rights for profit. And if we're going to have that, I think we really need to look at the different types of development that are happening in the Caribbean. And it also calls for a lot of, I would say, groundwork information to the persons on the ground, because if you look at it, I mean, sometimes most of these information are at the national level, where even those who are on the ground do not know what is really happening, especially where those persons who do not have access to the different technologies that are available in the different areas and the different communities around the Caribbean. So, for me, it's just ensuring that the rights of the people are not put at stake, you know, and giving them that information that is available for any type of development that is coming, and not really putting those people's rights, I would say, compromising the rights of the people, not putting our environment even at stake, you know, because we as people depend on the environment for our well-being. And so for me, that is very important. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Immaculata. And Sherlina, do you have any comments on that?
You know, if the Caribbean exists in 2030 or 2050, as current, it would be one, you know, where I hope there won't be any cruise ships coming anymore. It would be one where, you know, we sold each other food, we didn't import it from the West. Those are just two things that I would hope to see in the Caribbean that really centered. It would be migration, free migration, you know, among all our countries. You wouldn't have to fly to New York or Miami to get back somewhere else in the Caribbean. So, you know, I think if we really are serious about human rights, we need to think, about how we support each other, how we travel, share our resources, food, land being key.
Thanks so much, Sherlina. And Sapphire, you know, when you look into the future, when you move from, you know, being a youth activist and, you know, you've ascended into the future, what are you seeing in terms of what a Caribbean of the future would look like if it centers human rights?
I think if I look to the future, I'm going to put my most optimistic lens on, and I'm going to hope, as Shalina says, you know, the Caribbean is still here for us to enjoy and for us to live in. I think in reference to something that we've spoken about ad nauseum on this panel, I would hope that we would have a emphasis on environmental education. I would hope that we'd be able to lean into ancestral learnings about unity between people and the environment. I would hope that there would be greater investment in human resources and things like social services and general wellness of the human population. And I'd hope that would be greater emphasis on renewable energy and sustainable development. So when I look to the future, what I hope the Caribbean looks like, that's the image that I would see.
And Rowana, when you look to the future, what do you see?
I mean, a future of the Caribbean that centers human rights. That would be one where we don't think that the answer to crime is more violence, but state violence. Coming from Trinidad and Tobago, which is where I am, it is so ridiculous that at this point in global development, we still believe very much as a nation, as a people, at the policy government level, that criminality and crime should be answered with state violence. We do not see, we do not want to see the socioeconomic and environmental causes and linkages and relationship to criminal behavior and activity. And I feel as though in a Caribbean that centers human rights, we would very much move away from this. But yeah.
Just brilliantly said. And you know, my two cents to it is a Caribbean that centers human rights is a Caribbean in which, you know, the peoples of the Caribbean are celebrated and have space to develop and put forward their vision of progress and well-being. And it is a future in which our ecological and cultural heritage are safeguarded and protected. Because I really think that when communities, especially the ones that are marginalized now through ongoing processes of subordination and exclusion, you know, when these communities are empowered and have space to articulate a vision for the future and actually take steps to make it happen, I think the human rights of everyone and nature will be preserved. So that question of future and looking to the future and imagining is so important. And it kind of leads to the final question I have for the panel. And hopefully this will leave us on a positive note. The question is very simple, actually. What role does hope play in your work, knowing all the facts about climate change and the current policies in your country? And I can pick someone to start, but does anyone want to volunteer on that hopeful note? Immaculato, yes, go ahead, Immaculato.
Okay, well, why we need hope? What gives me hope? Well, we need hope in order to incentivize ourselves and others to transform the way we use, the way we consume, and the way we think. We need hope to want to make a change. At the Women's Conference of late that I had, it gave me hope that women will be the pioneers in making that change. And I know even in this space, we here are trying to make some change. And because we as women have noticed the change in our weather conditions, especially as Indigenous women, I would say. And It makes life a bit difficult for us, you know, especially those who are dependent on farming. And we have observed these very unusual times. For example, right now, I will just give you something that the fishes, they're supposed to be spawning until May, June. They're now spawning even in shallow waters, you know? So these are the things we're seeing that has never happened before. And it gives me hope that we can discuss the ways in which we have tried to adapt and also to the different situations that we have. And to see more of women learning about and being more open to mitigating approaches to climate change also gives me hope that the Caribbean will collectively experience a similar awakening of its environmental conscience and commit to effecting climate change. Whether that means continuing sustainable practices or adapting, as Indigenous women, we are the backbones of our communities, and we care about the world we leave behind for our children. That's why I mentioned my four children at the very beginning. And I think, therefore, we have committed to advancing our sustainable practices that we have used for generations. And we call on all others, you know, others wherever you are around the Caribbean, non-Indigenous women also in joining our fight for justice in solidarity. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Immaculata. Sherlina, any thoughts on hope?
Right, so hope is not really a word that I use a lot. It's not honestly a big part of my vocabulary. So I'm glad I'm not the last person to speak, because I actually, you know, it's going to get bad. It's already bad. Sorry, it's gonna get worse. And it's gonna get worse for lots more people. You know, we have already felt a lot of effects, and it's gonna just get worse. So that is the frame. But what keeps me going is just, as long as we are here, we have to take action. Like, we have to try to do whatever we can in whatever way we can to make it less bad than it's gonna be. And you know, I look at the region and I look at the Caribbean, like, as a region that has weathered so much, you know, from genocide of the indigenous people, the enslavement, you know, all the things our ancestors, you know, went through, and we are still here. And so, you know, the earth, there are forces, I think, beyond our realm of, you know, what we could measure. I think there are things at work that are bigger than us. And, you know, humans do a lot of damage, but the earth also is resilient and regenerates. And some of the damage, you know, is we can bring back species that have already gone extinct and so forth. But we just have to do as much as we can in the time that we have with resources and events like this that, you know, bring us together to share and learn from each other and to be motivated and energized are very meaningful. And yeah, so I don't have hope, but I have these other things. I'm not sure what the word is. But.
Thanks for your honesty, Sherlina, and very well received. Ruwana, any thoughts?
I couldn't do what I do if I didn't cling desperately to hope with the edge of my fingernails. I wish I could describe to you how disheartening it is at times to have to deal with this at the international level, where, you know, sometimes I feel like we're living in the upside down in terms of how discussions go. In this moment, though, in this specific moment, Sophia gives me hope. She gives me hope because she's a young person who understands the issue and who is doing what she can within her sphere of influence to advocate. That's all we have. That's all we have. All we have are, I think, the people who believe, as Shalina has said, that while we are here, we do what we can. And honestly, that gives me hope. That's what it comes down to. Because even in the context of the international discussion, sometimes it comes down to convincing one person about something to change the tide of the discussion and to shift the limit of possibility and what is possible. So I'll end by saying, I don't know how many of you have heard of the hashtag 1.5 to stay alive. That slogan was introduced into the climate process by Small Island Developing States in 2007. At the time, they were laughed out of the room, derided, and ignored. Everybody said, this is ridiculous. It's not possible. And furthermore, we're not doing it. And now we're in 2022, where arguably it is considerably less possible, but suddenly everyone agrees that this is what we should be doing. So if it wasn't for hope, we would have let go of that a long time ago, and it would not be here with us today. So I'll just leave it at that for now. Thanks.
Wow, Ruwana, that was so inspiring to listen to. And I think ending with Sapphire is such a fitting end to, you know, the last question of the discussion part. And we have about 10 minutes left. So I'd love to hear from Sapphire about, you know, the question of hope and the role it plays. And then I'll invite the panelists to, you know, make any final comments they want to make before we hand over. So Sapphire, no pressure.
No problem. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Ruwana. That means a lot. Because I think that especially for my generation, we grew up with that understanding of the impact of climate change and understanding that our futures would be significantly impacted by it. So growing up and in our generation, it can feel sometimes really difficult to find hope because you're dealing with an environmental crisis, you're dealing with health crises left and right, you're dealing with an unemployment crisis on top of that, you're dealing with inflation and recession and everything all at once. And at times it can feel like, what's the point of continuing to advocate, continuing to scream, continuing to beg for lawmakers to listen to us and to champion change for our futures, because this is what they're leaving us with. But I firmly hold on to hope. Hope is at the center of my activism always, because sometimes hope is it is all I have. Hope is literally at times all I have. We do an exercise at the end of all of our community meetings where we ask our participants to envision a feminist or a sustainable future. We consciously do that exercise because we understand how difficult it is to hold on to optimism right now, seeing the conditions for women and girls here in the Caribbean, here specifically in Trinidad and Tobago, seeing the condition of the environment. So yeah, hope is everything for me. Hope is what keeps me going. Hope is what fuels my community, and hope is what fuels my activism. This room being here today fills me with so much hope, listening to such intellectual, powerful, incredible women come together and to share the work that they are championing in their communities here in the Caribbean. That I cannot tell you how much that fills me with hope to know that, you know, we're not doomed. I mean, in some ways we are, but there's still that work being done. There's still that passion and there's still that community. So that for me, hope is everything, and hope is sometimes all I have.
Wow, Sapphire, that's just such a, all of these comments, it's such a powerful and inspiring way to end a discussion on climate crisis. And I hope the hopefulness in this panel, you know, that you heard from the panelists will activate and, you know, just really push people to move forward despite how, you know, the doom and gloom language that we hear about climate crisis. So in the 7 minutes that we have left, I just want to invite the panelists to make any, you know, closing remarks they'd like to make and, you know, in a couple of minutes. And then I will hand over to Christine to kind of, you know, close out the session. So maybe we can start with Immaculata and we just go around to hear any closing remarks.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us. And I feel so honored to be on the panel with this, with all of you, amazing women, powerful women, I would say. And from this evening, I feel so inspired. I've learned from you, and I feel motivated to continue the fight. And I know collectively, wherever we are located, wherever we are in the Caribbean, that we are all working towards one cause. And as our last speaker says, that gives me hope that we know that we will continue to work on climate justice. Thank you.
Thanks, Immaculata. And Sherlina?
Right. I'm very happy to have been part of this panel, and I look forward to the next couple of days. I just put a link in the chat, which is for a petition that we are circulating currently, calling on the government of Guyana to stop, to halt oil and gas activities. We're inviting people outside of Guyana, especially other Caribbean citizens to sign petition, because, you know, when there is a spill from the oil drilling in Guyana, it's not gonna just affect Guyana, it's gonna affect, you know, it's gonna travel in the Caribbean multiple countries. So I will just end by asking people to take action, sign the petition, and keep on caring and keep on taking action in your communities.
Thanks so much, Sherlina. Ruana?
I'll probably just say that this has been great. Thank you so much for the invitation to participate. Thank you to the panelists for their brilliance, and to you, Malini, for your excellent, insightful facilitation. This has been an honor for me. Thank you so much.
And Sapphire?
Yeah, I think for me, it's about the same. I just want to say thank you so, so much to all of you here on the panel today. Thank you so much to the organizers, to the participants who came and helped facilitate such a fruitful discussion. Some of those comments and questions were incredible. Thank you so much, Malini, for guiding us through this conversation and providing such intelligent input. I've learned so much today, and I'm so grateful to have been able to sit in this room, you know, virtually, among such brilliance. And I can't wait for tomorrow, for tomorrow's panel. Yeah, thank you so much, everyone.
And thank you to the panelists for teaching me. I really enjoyed this discussion. And thank you to the organizers as well for this amazing initiative. And I can't wait to see what's next in your work. So on that hopeful note, I will hand over to Christine and Derval to close out the session. Thanks so much.
Thank you, everyone. What a powerful session and such a great way to start this conference. The conversation was definitely impactful, and we are proud to have you working for justice in our various countries. We are proud to know you. It is clear that climate justice is related to all other forms of injustice. There is no climate justice without human rights. Even indigenous communities that practice sustainable practices are facing the effects of food insecurity. This crisis is urgent, and our panelists made that clear. Development doesn't only mean buildings and roads, We need services for the people. We need people to be informed about their decisions, not to be brainwashed. We need to think of the seven generations down, not just the five-year election cycle. There is a disconnect between what is happening at the top of sustainability talk and that on the ground. We need to value the environment. Human rights can be compromised for profits. Wellness must be centered. Free migration between our countries, greater investment in humans, renewable energy, where we don't think the answer to crime is more violence. The Caribbean of the future is where people of the Caribbean are celebrated, our ecological and our cultural heritage are safeguarded. And when we talk of hope, hope for us is everything. Hope fuels our action. It means coming together. Young people brings hope. Hope is something that we all need despite it all. Hope is everything and it fuels our activism. On behalf of the conference, we'll just like to say thank you so much for your words, Rowana, Sherlina, Immaculata, Sapphire, and thank you so much for your kind moderating, Malini. Thank you to our audience for staying engaged throughout. So with this, I'm gonna pass it over to Deval for some final words.
Thank you, Christine. What an incredible start to Caribbean Women for Climate Justice Conference. Oh, so inspiring. Thank you to everyone, as Christine said. And so we are fired up for the rest of this four-day virtual event. So please join us tomorrow for day two, which is also eighth day, for our eighth day panel, and also our keynote speaker, Ms. Aisha Constable of Girls Care. So with that, I thank you and I wish everyone a good night.